we good to start?
Yeah, I shouldn't have to do any more killing sprees for at least a few minutes.
So this episode is kind of a follow-up episode. We've done 5 podcasts and various things have come up or been missed or things like that. And so everything is kind of themed around follow-up. And then depending on how long we go, maybe we'll do other topics as well. We've got one to bring up. But I wanted to lead off with something... we should lead off with beer.
Of course.
That's always what we do. So let's lead off with beer. Mike, what are you drinking?
I am drinking a Spaten Opten Mata. It's very good. Very, very good German beer.
I am drinking Wild Blue, a premium blueberry lager, and it's 8% alcohol by volume.
Yay, always a good time.
And I have to say that it actually does have a wonderful blueberry finish.
Huh,
okay.
I'm not quite sure how the brewers manage that, but I toast to them.
Yeah, it's always nice when it has that kind of crisp end to it. I don't know how they manage to do that, but you know, that's one of the things I like about lagers. The whatever else you can say about it, particularly the well-chilled, it just has this nice crisp finish in a way that Guinness, for example, just sits there like an elephant.
A very tasty elephant.
Yes.
Do you eat many elephants?
Yeah, I'm going to play the fifth.
The advice that I have given people from time to time that was given to me on learning Catholicism, so to speak, was eat the elephant one bite at a time. There's a lot of it.
Very true.
I think you've striven to take big bites.
We'll come back to that.
Unhinged, may have unhinged your jaw.
Follow up, so silly. What a snake. I'm on an Urban Pale Ale 312 from Goose Island, which is always a nice standby. I apologize, I sound terrible. I sound much worse than I feel. So I'm just gonna push through and drink lots of tea with honey in it along with my 312.
nothing a little beer and honey can't cure, I'm sure.
I haven't had a honey beer for a while, actually. I have a few, Michelob has a honey beer, but I haven't seen many craft brew honey beers. Wasn't that one out of, somewhere local, somewhere?
Yeah, there's a local honey beer, I can't remember.
I remember trying that and it was pretty good.
Yeah, it was at Basler's once. I don't think I tried it, but I did see it there and was a bit tempted by it.
It was the one that I saw. It was very good. Now, I want to start with a follow-up item from episode 2, where we talked about the Just War theory. Because there was a fun little article, and we've talked a lot, we seem to talk about sci-fi at the start of the podcast, and I figured I could put the two together. There's a neat article, an op-ed in the Washington Post, that argues that the destruction of Alderaan was a perfectly legitimate military exercise. Alderaan was, if not a legitimate military target, then there was every reason for the Empire to destroy it, and that it was the least worst means available. And then all this, you know, pro-alliance propaganda that you've seen to the contrary really shouldn't dissuade you. Do you think the destruction of Alderaan met the just war requirements?
I'll be honest, it's been a while since I've seen the original trilogy, so I'm not entirely certain. When I was watching it, I was fairly young, so I wasn't really analyzing the film in light of the Just War theory.
Even given most of the assumptions that the author makes in the piece, that Princess Leia is lying whenever she says it's a peaceful planet with no weapons.
Every word out of her mouth up to that point to her captors has been a lie.
Well, yeah, I don't blame her. Even given that, no, it is not just war. I mean, you don't destroy an entire village because there's collaborators in the village.
Well, but the author makes the point that actually that is what we talked about. When we were talking about just war before, we were talking about it specifically in the context of Hiroshima. Or Hiroshima? Which do we say in America?
Hiroshima.
Okay. We were talking in the context of Hiroshima, and the article argues that actually this is analogous to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You are using a weapon of enormous destructive potential, and there is going to be collateral civilian damage, but in some contexts it's justifiable. I don't think any of us said we wouldn't have dropped the bomb.
War wasn't declared. The so-called rebellion was trying to... I mean, it was an insurgency, that was also trying to use political maneuvering within the Senate to...
One thing I think that's worth talking about is something you brought up last time, Simon, which is that when you're talking about competing world powers, where they both kind of have most of the same toolbox, that makes it easier to justify that sort of scorched earth kind of tactic.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that existed in the Star Wars universe?
No. And actually, I like... First of all, credit for remembering that. but I think Mike's thing about the insurgency thing is an interesting analogy, because we have earned the opprobrium of some sections by bombing jihadists and so on. And so there's obviously a continuum between a massive bombing of, say, a mountain range. Or was it the Tora Bora complex, am I saying that right?
Yes.
You know, I seem to remember that we carpet bombed that.
Yes.
But if they'd been hiding in downtown Kabul and we'd carpet bombed Kabul, then that would probably not have been justifiable.
Maybe it
would have. But let's use that as the example. Is there no context in which you could strike a civilian population center to kill jihadists? Because we do that all the time, just with smaller collateral damage. Is there a zone past which, or is it a hard number?
Well, no, because it's war. I think that a lot of it has to do... If you have the technology to spare life, then you should use that.
Mm-hmm.
And we do.
Yeah, and we do. So therefore, no, we don't carpet bomb Kabul.
But if someone is in a an apartment in Kabul, and the way to get them, the only way to do it is going to take out that building, I think, rightly or wrongly, we would probably do that, right?
It depends on the situation.
Okay.
If there's active fighting going on in Kabul, and there's, you know, people firing RPGs at helicopters from this apartment building, then yeah, we're going to blow up that apartment building.
So then the next question becomes, on the same premise, do you take out a city block? I don't assume that they have city blocks neatly on a grid system, but, you know, a block-sized area. Again, on the same premise that you have, this is kind of like an Al-Qaeda ghetto kind of thing. Being used to store weapons and shield fighters, but that still has a pretty good civilian population.
No.
So that's the hard cutoff. At that point, that's not...
Because I would take the Fallujah example to that. What we did whenever we retook Fallujah...
Bless you.
..is... Yeah. ..is we surrounded the city. We let them know for 2 weeks... that, hey, we're going to be coming into the city. So the civilian population could evacuate. We had drones overhead, so we watched them move, and then we went in there and wrecked it. So that's what you do, is if you had a block where you knew Al-Qaeda had a whole bunch of weapons, jihadists had a whole bunch of weapons, you wouldn't necessarily, you wouldn't drop a JDAM and destroy an entire block that's on top of, a hospital or something like that.
So what Tarkin should have done was send a message to Alderaan that says, all of you who aren't rebel scum, leave. And those of you who are rebel scum, hang around and expect trouble in a week.
No, what Tarkin should have done is he should have sat the Death Star right outside of there, cut off all communications between Alderaan and elsewhere, and bombed the Royal Palace.
Mm-hmm.
He should have took some TIE fighters, sent the TIE fighters right down, and made the Royal Palace rubble, because the royal family was clearly supporting the rebellion.
Of course, you can do that with a Star Destroyer. The Death Star is essentially the ultimate big gun diplomacy piece.
Yeah.
Right.
The Death Star had tons and tons of TIE fighter wings. Mm-hmm. They could have deployed those. The other thing in the piece is that he said it's not genocide because there's other humans elsewhere all over the galaxy.
Mm-hmm. That's not very persuasive.
That's a
hey, guess what? Holocaust, no longer genocide.
That's
right. By that standard.
Yeah, that's a fantastic category error. Just because we don't know whether or not Alderaan had a unique culture, but we'd have to assume it does. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that qualifies as genocide. Mm-hmm. Destroying completely and entirely their culture.
What other category could we assign it to if not genocide? Well, is there a term for destroying an entire... Because gens, I thought, was Latin for nation. And so you couldn't have a nation-ocide, because that's, I mean, it's literally the same derivation.
See, his argument...
Mass murder.
Yeah.
It would just be mass murder.
Yeah,
governments don't like it when you call their policies mass murder.
I know, that's why I make a habit of doing it.
Gens means race or people.
Okay.
But the author's point was that because the empire wasn't destroying like the Wookiees of Kashyyyk, who only live on Kashyyyk, then it's not genocide. But destroying an entire species, and a sapient species, would be something else.
And that doesn't even hold up, because, I mean, obviously a space-faring civilization, there are going to be Wookiees not on Kashyyyk.
Some, but it'd be, the Jews. It'd be a diaspora thing.
You know, that does bring up the elephant in the room, or perhaps the Ewok in the room, which is the Endor Holocaust. Right? Which defenders of the rebellion never mention the Endor Holocaust, even though that's probably closer to what you're discussing, because the Ewoks were, if not subsapient, at the very least they were not an interplanetary civilization. Mm-hmm. And yet it's very clear from the end of Return of the Jedi that immediately after it cuts to immediately following that, the entire planet is fragged, because you've just blown up an object the size and mass of a moon and directly injected, I mean, I haven't worked the spherical geometry, but about 80% of its mass directly into the planet.
How do Han... Because, like, whenever that explodes, you know, Han's on the planet, Leia's on the planet, and they spend the evening of everything raining on the planet barbecuing with the Ewoks. Mm-hmm. How do they survive that?
Well, that's one of the theories that that what you're seeing above are not fireworks, but the ejector from the other 20% of the Death Star coming back down. I mean, you know, you can't blow up an object that size in close orbit.
Yeah.
And not expect it to. I mean, there are big chunks of it that directly impact the biosphere, but then all of that stuff that's being vaporized by the explosion is still particulate matter. It still exists, and it's all going to be injected into the atmosphere. And then you've got everything in between, from the size of a piece of dust up to a large continental sized chunk, that's all going to come raining down. But you know, I mean, it doesn't have to happen instantly. But that entire biosphere is dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if that's in any of the. I seem to remember it's in one of the expanded universe novels. I think at least references it, but it's something that doesn't get talked about, because most of the fandom is, of course, pro-rebellion. Not surprisingly, because they're the heroes of the movie. Even if you think back to the Thrawn trilogy, where you had the bad guy portrayed in a very sympathetic, flattering light, mm-hmm. it was still very clear that he was the bad guy, mm-hmm. and that you were supposed to feel bittersweet when he lost.
Yeah, it was sort of a John Milton's Paradise Lost kind of dynamic.
Yeah. So let's do some follow-up items. Let's see what we got here. Episode 1, we talked about Tinder quite a lot, and Sam, you had something in the show notes of a New York Times article on Tinder but off sex.
There is an article by a young woman talking about her sexual experiences and how they kind of stopped during the age of Tinder, when one would think that they would be picking up. What I find somewhat heartening is that this particular individual, who doesn't share my moral intuitions in the slightest, has, for better or for worse, chosen to be abstinent for the past couple of years. And what's interesting is that she says that she's accidentally abstaining from sex. But the reality is, we all know, there is in fact a fairly large pool of men out there who would be happy to have sex with her for a night if that's what she wanted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And Tinder gives her access and, to.
Yeah, it's quite clear in the piece that it's not accidental. It's intentional. All of her friends are encouraging her to lower her standards. All of her friends are encouraging her to continue to have one-night stands. And she's just not interested in that, rightly so.
Yeah, I think it's very healthy.
Speaking of sex, we talked on episode 3, the infamous robot sex episode, and it turns out that there was a robot sex conference planned that has now been cancelled. Yes. They were going to have a symposium, the second iteration of this symposium, to talk about robot sex issues, and that they're in favour of it, this organising group. And then they made the tactical error of deciding to hold it in Malaysia.
Yeah.
Which is not terribly socially liberal.
Seems like a bad call.
There are worse countries to hold it in, but not by much.
Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
The Saudis are, you know, fairly tolerant of some things, but I don't think robot sex is on the list.
Yeah.
They probably still treat robots better than women.
Probably.
I don't know. Are the robots women? Like, are these female robots?
Well, how do you define a female robot?
Here we go.
Right, yeah. We talked about robot sex and AI, so you can obviously have a robot that has female body parts, but does that make the robot female?
I would think that the Saudis would treat the female robots better than the human females, because the female robots cost more. It takes a lot of money to build a female robot. So you don't want to, like, beat it or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Voids the warranty, don't you know?
Warning, bondage may void warranty.
Oh, gosh.
You know, this robot is not rated for encounters above.
The brave new world. Mm-hmm. It is upon us.
They said in that article, I think, that they expect this to be a normal thing by 2050. And so certainly in our lifetimes, you know, we're going to have to start thinking about some of these issues. My point in the last one was that you start off with this problem of robot sex, and then move into the AI piece that tendered. At a certain point, these things become smart enough that it's no longer a thing. And
you get into issues of, you know, rape.
Yeah, exactly. But then, you know, at a point at which you have... Here's the follow-on to that. At the point at which you have sapient robots, and you are deliberately choosing to build sub-sapient robots for menial tasks, does that become an ethical problem? Because you have constructed two iterations of a mechanical race, one of which is sapient and one of which isn't. Are the sapient robots going to think, you know, there but for the grace of God go I? Or are they going to feel that, you know, they have this kind of kindred race? Similar to in somewhere along the line in Battlestar, we learned that the raiders are sapient life forms that have been deliberately retarded by the Cavil faction. And the sixes and the eights, I think, are very unhappy about this. You know, how dare you treat our, you know, cousins, brethren, whatever you want to think of it as, in this way? How dare you make them subsapient when they're fully capable of functioning as a sapient organism? Does that kind of stuff start to come up in positing that kind of division?
Was
it just a manufacturing spec?
If we took a sapient robot, or a sapient AI, and then made it subsapient, that would be an ethical problem. If we continue to create subsapient intelligence, subsapient robots, that's not an ethical problem. We're going to have smart refrigerators that aren't self-aware. We're going to have smart coffee makers that aren't self-aware. I don't see that being a problem, but I could see, whenever we create sapient robots, sapient AI, I could see them having a problem with us continuing to do so. But Yeah, I don't see that as being an ethical problem on our end.
So you think Vicky from iRobot would not necessarily have kinship or feelings of kinship with a pocket calculator?
She might, but that's an issue on her part. I wouldn't fault us to continue to use pocket calculators. But Vicky, especially if we build AI with simulated emotions, then I could see them having kinship with these subsapient things that we use, and the same thing that we have kinship with monkeys, with dogs, with other organic life forms.
It's difficult to imagine what that world looks like, but it's the frightening thing is it's not terribly far away.
No, it's not far away at all.
Yeah. Now is the time to start thinking about it. Is this a post-singularity question? I know Ray Kurzweil likes to talk about the singularity and all that kind of stuff. But I don't even see that as a post-singularity problem. I mean, that's going to happen very soon.
It depends on how you define the singularity. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, my recollection, and correct me if I'm vague or wrong on this, is that his conception of the singularity was that the point past which we can't project any further because technology will have just reached a compression point.
Yeah.
Am I wrong about that?
No, that's true. I mean, he thinks that he can predict fairly well what's going to happen up to a certain point,
mm-hmm.
and that our technology is going to be so advanced that it radically alters the possibilities of what we're going to do, and he has no idea after that point. And he's prepared for that point by doing some very interesting things. He's changed his diet to extend his longevity and until he can be incorporated into a... some sort of artificial intelligence container.
Gosh. You sure you're not confusing Ray Kurzweil with Sheldon Cooper?
No,
I think this was an influence.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this is pretty typical Ray Kurzweil stuff.
Yeah.
Am I wrong to think that this may be a lot of fuss about nothing? Because is it not true to say that the only thing that distinguishes the singularity in the sense that he means from any technological revolution? Think of the computing revolution. Think about the movable type printing press. Anything like that. The only thing that's special about this one is it's been predicted. But someone could just as well have said in 1400 that, you know, our technology is moving quickly. We're developing in ways that are not necessarily predictable. And at some point in the future, something is going to happen that is going to make everything beyond that point unforeseeable. You know, and it was the printing press, you know, and that would have been true. It just wouldn't have been a particularly exciting observation. Are we just anxious about it because it's the future? Is it kind of millenarian angst?
I think we're anxious about it in part because technology has taken a new role in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bigger issue for us because technology in general has become a bigger part of our lives, whereas before it was less of a part of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're still very much human beings first, tool users second,
mm-hmm.
and now we are primarily tool users.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not just capable of making and using tools. We're actively being shaped by our tools,
mm-hmm.
and so that puts a very different kind of importance for us onto the way our tools change.
I think the other thing is that in the past we can conceptualize and understand what future technology will do. You know, Jules Verne was able to conceptualize, okay, we're going to have technology that'll allow us to fly from place to place. We're going to have technology that'll allow us to go to the moon or go deep under the ocean. Or transmit information from place to place. He could easily understand that. But what does it mean to take a consciousness and upload it onto the internet? What does it mean to be able to understand and utilize quantum states or any number? What does it mean to understand and utilize, you know, the fact that time space is rounded? You know, if we can harness that, what does that mean? And frankly, we don't know. we can't conceptualize that easily in our minds. And so I think that's what's so scary.
I wonder if that may be a little overstated on two fronts. And the first would be thinking of the false positives in Byrne's work. So you think of Voyage to the Center of the Earth, a Journey to the Center of the Earth. That's a false positive because it made a prediction that in the future we will have the technology and the interest to do this, and it didn't pan out that way. We look back now and say, well, he was prescient because he proposed the invention of the plane or the rocket ship and all that kind of stuff, because that's a successful one. But we tend to overlook the ones where he made predictions that didn't pan out. But then the other one would be, just focusing on the plane, for example, because it's the example that's easiest for me. It wasn't a particularly brilliant insight to envisage that mankind might one day be able to build planes and fly through the air. But when he made that prediction, it would have been very difficult to imagine the kind of social ramifications of what that would mean for humanity when once the what we now call the jet age and the globalization of the economy and all the things that followed from that technology, which is really what you're talking about. When you say that that it's difficult for us to predict what's going to happen socially in consequence of these various technologies, it's kind of the same thing. You know, you're not talking about the advent of the technology itself. We can predict that we are going to discover some new kind of power source, for example. It may be fusion, it may be something else. We may develop some kind of fundamental new insight that takes us through into undiscovered paths. But it's not difficult to kind of speculate, and science fiction does this all the time, on what kind of technologies may have. But then it's much more difficult to speculate on what are the social ramifications of that technology, and that really isn't too much different, is it?
My one thing is, in studying technology, the social ramifications of technology follows a pattern. You can compare the social ramifications of the printing press to the social ramifications of the internet. And it's happening on different scales and at different time frames, but it's similar. You can compare the social ramifications of the building of galleons to trains or trains to planes. And once again, it's a different time frame. You know, planes allow us to do it a lot quicker. But it's a similar impact. I'm not sure what comparatively the social ramifications of uploading consciousness would be, if it's at all possible, which I'm skeptical about the possibility of that. I'm not sure what the social ramifications of sapient artificial intelligence are going to be compared to other things. It's difficult to make those sorts of comparisons.
We've never invented an intelligence before.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we've invented modes of transportation. We've invented modes of communication. We've not invented any new intelligence.
Yeah, we've never given birth to a new species. And that's in essence what we would be doing whenever we create a sapient AI, is we're giving birth to a new form of life.
Which may not share our intuitions. One of the things that has done the rounds, I saw it again this week, but it's been doing the rounds for 8 months or so, was the ethics of self-driving cars. We're going to have to tell AIs these people are more valuable than others. So when you're about to get into an accident and you can kill the driver, the pedestrian, or the gaggle of children crossing the road in front of you, this is the least valuable, this is the most valuable, this is the order in which you should try and avoid killing these people. And that's probably going to be influential on the fully sapient AIs that follow, because I would imagine that if they are indeed intelligent, one of the things that they're going to do is look back and say, well, okay, you know, this is what, you know, these are the moral intuitions that were programmed into my immediate predecessors. What do I think of that? You know, that becomes a good place to start in terms of it forming its own moral intuitions, which inevitably it'll do. That's probably the definition of a of a sapient AI.
Well, what makes us sapient is our tool making capacity, our tool utilization capacity. So perhaps a better way of saying that is it relates to our frontal lobe rather than our sapience. I'm interested in the legal ramifications of self-driving cars. Because it's difficult to say who we're going to hold liable if it's not clear if the who is sapient or not.
Well, okay, here's a departure point for that. Think of the next nearest analog to that, which would be the autopilot. The autopilot is pretty dumb, but they've gotten more advanced. They don't just keep it flying in a straight line anymore. And so if someone dies as a result of the autopilot, you know, if the pilots pass out and the autopilot kills someone, I think usually we would say that the airline is responsible corporately, as compared to the Lufthansa crash, where the pilot is, I mean, I don't know how European law works, but I would assume that the pilot is personally liable, and if the airline is liable in any way, it's because they failed to adequately screen the pilot, mm-hmm. rather than because yes. they have any direct complicity in his action. But that, I think, may just be a default rule because we don't know what else to do with liability in that case, and we have an intuition that it has to lie somewhere. I mean, the Hillary Clinton people want to be able to sue gun manufacturers for people who kill people using guns. So are the auto manufacturers a good place to look for liability in that kind of situation? By parity of reasoning.
That's what's been proposed. I read an article from the Brookings Institution mm-hmm. Talking about that as an option. Mm-hmm. There's some risks to that, obviously. You could essentially, if you were to do that, incentivize people to stop building self-driving cars.
Yes, exactly.
And that could potentially be a problem because I would actually suspect that if we had effective self-driving cars, we would cut down significantly on the amount of traffic deaths that we have. I mean, so in a sense, we may have an ethical obligation to utilize self-driving cars if they're going to significantly reduce traffic deaths.
Is this a case where legislation might be necessary because we need to be able to indemnify auto manufacturers, and the way to do that is to say, as a community, this is the order of victimhood. You know, that these lives matter more than other people's, and as long as the AI that you put into your car follows these rules, then you will not be indemnified. And if so, then where does liability land in that case? Or is it wrong to think that liability has to land anywhere? Well, is it conceivable that we would say that it's a self-driving car, it's non-sapient, it's not an AI, therefore there is no liability?
I would say that ultimately, liability first and foremost lies with the person behind the wheel who chooses to engage the self-driving car. Provided that there's an option to engage or not engage the self-driving car. From there, if it can be shown that there's an inherent flaw in the system, mm-hmm. like the AI should have disengaged the speed, like the AI took the turn, clearly took the turn too fast and should have known that but didn't, then they should have liability. The auto manufacturer should have liability. But provided that the artificial intelligence is being used, that the self-driving car is being used correctly according to the manufacturers, but it's being misused mm-hmm. by the driver, then the liability should file on the driver. I'm thinking like these cases we have with Tesla, mm-hmm. where Tesla has just introduced the self-driving mechanism, but it's a rather dumb self-driving mechanism. They say, be careful how you use it. And we have someone who did a cannonball run from one coast of the United States to the other, made very good time, and they got praised by Elon Musk for it, but they probably shouldn't have done that. Or someone took a turn at 80 miles an hour mm-hmm. in their car and almost went off the side of a cliff because it didn't slow down and the car didn't follow the normal way you take a turn, because it's not designed to do that.
I like a lot of that. The one part that I'm a little skeptical of is you suggested that, if the person engages the autopilot, so to speak, then that may put them on the hook for liability, but then doesn't that produce exactly the same kind of disincentives that Sam was talking about? If you put liability on the car manufacturers, then the response is they just don't make those kinds of things that we want. Well, in the same way, if you say to someone, you're going to be on the hook if you turn on the AI, then they're not going to turn on the AI, and we want to encourage them to do that because there are presumably fewer deaths.
No, because individuals don't account for risk in the same way that corporate entities do. We pay lawyers to account for those risks. Individuals don't. And
I think they do. I mean, you know, maybe not in the same way.
Not in the same way. And at this stage in the game, what we have right now is a very experimental system. And we need to have, you know, you need to have people out there testing it. But ultimately, especially with an experimental system, the impetus is on the individual whether or not to use that or not.
How sure are we that we want to have self-driving cars as compared to, you've seen commercials for these ones that will stop themselves. If you point it at a brick wall, it won't run into it. So this kind of semi-AI car, is that, might we think that that is a better solution in some ways than the fully AI vehicle?
I don't see how.
Well, because then you're simply saying, here are some parameters. You're not putting the AI in charge of it, and you're not asking the AI to make decisions. You're just telling the car. Let's say you mentioned the guy who, the quintessential take the corner too fast kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
You have a LADAR system on the front of the car that is aware of the geometry of the corner that is coming up, because it can figure out where is asphalt and where is grass, and so it knows what the road's about to do. And if you're telling it, hey, drive around this corner at 90, it's going to think, that's a bad idea. I'm not going to do that. And so it'll drop your speed down to a slightly less suicidal 60, for example. But you're still ultimately, you're the one driving it. It's just grabbing and slowing you down.
Well, I mean, if a car is capable of judging the turn and saying that this is too fast, then it's capable of driving itself. That is an essential, because that's a step up from determining, oh, you're too close to another car, stop.
You can also imagine, you can imagine cases where that will actually create a problem, where the human is trying to make the car do it. I mean, obviously Jeremy Clarkson will hate it, right? But there are legitimately cases in which the human is smart enough to know that I've got to do whatever, and the AI will fight the human and potentially cause an accident.
That's whenever you have an override. And it's interesting. I was reading Google recently released all of its data with the cars, with their self-driving cars, and released every one of its accidents. And the accidents with the self-driving cars all have to do with the cars driving too well. It's driving not like a human. It's driving precisely well, and like a car behind it expects it to run the yellow, but it doesn't. Or it's just sitting there and some car runs into it. Stuff like that.
Really, can you hold someone responsible if they're going to drive at the speed limit? Then they're just asking for someone to get out of the red light and shoot them in the face. It's 30. You're driving at 30?
Yeah.
What is wrong with you? We would have to get more realistic about speed limits. We talked on the last episode about firearms and... I forget exactly. I read this before I came here. But anyway, one of the things that was in the show notes that we didn't get to talk about was straw purchases. And I wondered if you wanted to... You had put down in the show notes, and I wondered if you wanted to talk more about it.
Yeah, this was an article by Kevin Williamson pointing out that prosecutors are not going after people who make straw purchases, or in other words, people who are purchasing on the behalf of others. So, like, if I was a convicted felon and I convinced Simon to go buy me some weapons, then Simon would be making a straw purchase. And this is a felony. But prosecutors don't go after them because it's small time, and also because the people making straw purchases happen to be oftentimes elderly family members. Mm. Like, these gangbangers will get their grandmother to go in and make purchases for them, or their uncle, or whatnot.
Is it legal to solicit a straw purchase? Well, let me rephrase. It's probably, you probably, in the same way, you know, suborning any felony, but is it specific? It would be nice if it was specifically an independent crime with various things attached to it to solicit a straw purchase.
Right, in the same way that we have a specific charge for soliciting a prostitute.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would assume so. I would imagine that it's it would be an attempt to illegally acquire a handgun or something like that, and I assume
that gives you the tool to escape the problem that you're describing, where the actual perp is quite sympathetic, and allows you to go after the real party in interest. And I think Kerry's pieces suggest that there are cases where it's really quite brazen, where, you know, the person who's actually the actual party in interest goes into the gun shop with them and says, yeah, that one, Grandma.
There was a recent case, I can't remember the state, but there was a case where these people of gun crimes, I think it was a cop's family, sued a gun store over an instance like this, because someone went in to buy guns for a relative that couldn't buy guns. Whenever filling out the application of the background check, they said, you know, are you buying these guns for another person? They said yes, and the store instructed them to change it to no, and stuff like that. And so they were sued. They ended up getting sued because of that. And I think that the case is still pending.
So my intuition is that that's probably I don't know where the law is on it, but that would be a kind of case where I would support liability for the seller, where you know you know full well that this person, that the real party in interest is someone that you can't sell to, and you do anyway, and indeed you actually make it easier for them to do so. You know, I'm not generally in favor of liability of stores for selling anything to anyone. But, you know, when you have those kinds of restrictions, then it seems like an ideal kind of case.
It seems to me that proving that in court, at least to the degree that you or I would be comfortable with it, would be rather difficult. You know, you'd have to have, like, the case of the surveillance of the person coming in and pointing out the gun they want, or the store admitting that, yeah, they said they were buying the gun for their cousin or whatnot.
Maybe that's one of the things that disincentivizes prosecution. It's tough to get an indictment.
It's not necessarily tough to get an indictment, because what you do is you arrest the guy with the handgun, and you do a trace on the handgun. The handgun's registered to their mother. Their handgun's registered to their grandma, and that's proof enough. Of course, what happens in places like Chicago is they don't even prosecute the gangbanger for illegal. They don't prosecute felons for illegally owning a firearm because it's too much. There's too many cases.
Last time, or episode 4, I think, we said that Jim Webb and Lincoln Chafee didn't count, and then they promptly agreed with us and jumped out. Biden then stayed out, and I think everyone agrees that Jeb is fingering the ripcord. Do we want to put Jeb on a death watch and make a bet as to how long before he bails out? Well, okay, so let me put it this way. You think Trump's going to stay until the first ballot's in?
Yes.
I think Trump will stay in until he drops to second consistently, and he's now second to Carson in Iowa, and I forget which other poll. Do you think Jeb will stay in that long, or is he just dead man walking at this point?
It depends on his finances. It all depends on whether or not he can continue to fund his campaign. If he can continue to fund his campaign, he's going to stay in. But if his friends are on the line saying, look, you need to get out and give that money to someone who can actually win, then he might pull it before Iowa. But I think that Trump's in it until Iowa, unless he has, if he has another horrible debate performance, if he has another performance where he doesn't talk nearly as much, then he might jump. We'll have to see. It'll be interesting to see how Trump performs in the Fox Business debate coming up November 10th.
Am I right to think that everyone's take on CNBC debate was my candidate won and CNBC lost?
Yes.
Substituting the name of whoever candidate you like.
You know, for as horrible of a job as CNBC did, perhaps they should host all of our debates.
You know, what struck me about it was not that it was there was bias and all of the usual Republican complaints about the media, which was all true, but just how utterly inept they were as journalists.
Yes, yes. I stunk.
So one of the things that strikes me about Oliver Stone is how incompetent he is at making hit pieces. Because you think about Nixon, right? The movie that he made somehow managed the inconceivable feat of making Dick Nixon look sympathetic. And if you think about W, I think that was the name of his Bush movie, which again, making George Bush look pretty sympathetic. When your goal is to make a thing that's just a shiv in the ribs against someone, and you keep consistently making them look pretty good, you know, that's kind of pretty poor performance. And it's the same thing with, I can't even remember, the girl and the main guy, whose name is escaping me, John something, were just so pathetic at their kind of mishandled attempts to stick the knife in the ribs. It was just like, is this your first time? Are you guys just, you know, amateur? Oh, this is just, you know, there are people who have done much more well-executed hits on candidates than this. I mean, you think back to Fiorina in the second debate where they asked her about Trump and his comments about her, and she just stuck the knife in the ribs and walked away. You know, and you compare that to the kind of inept attempts of CNBC to do the same thing. So not terribly impressive.
Yeah,
I thought one of the questions was really fascinating. What is your biggest weakness? And it was posed as this sort of you're engaging in a job interview to be the president of America, and this is a typical job interview question. And I thought that was a really odd question. Not because it's a bad question. It's actually an extremely good question that can tell you a lot about a candidate. But because I can't imagine asking that question and expecting politicians to give me a serious answer to it on a national debate stage.
Yeah.
Now, if this were like a cozy interview after their campaign had already fizzled out, they might give me a candid answer about that. If I were lucky. But no way would they ever give me a candid answer about their actual weaknesses. During the, you know, primetime debates, there's no way. I can't even imagine asking that question and thinking, boy, this is going to go well.
I acknowledge all that, but it was still disappointing that they immediately, like John Kasich immediately said, screw your question, I'm just going to talk about what I want to talk about.
How else do you handle that?
I care too much.
Humor is the way.
Yeah.
This is similar to the question about your Secret Service code name that a lot of people deride it. To me, that kind of question is a test of the candidate's ability to comprehend things like self-deprecation is attractive, and you know, I don't make everything deadly serious, and so just as Rand Paul failed that test. I'm screaming eagle of freedom is my secret service code name, or whatever it was. Kasich in the same way. This was a gimme to say something, to come up with something about. And maybe I'm being unfair picking on Kasich, because of course he was the first person who had to answer this, and because he bloviated for several minutes. Everyone else should have had this queued up. My recollection is that Rubio had a pretty good answer. But this is your opportunity to come up with. And Ted Cruz actually had a great answer, a sarcastic answer on it. But this is your opportunity to show some humor and to acknowledge the kernel of truth in whatever your public caricature is. And so Donald Trump's answer, because it was a gimme, should have been, you know, I just have too many bad hair days. That's your answer. It's deft, it's self-deprecating, it's funny, it's a gimme. Right. And they all failed. As I say, maybe I should fault Rand Paul more for the Screaming Eagle of Freedom line, because he had time to think about it. He was at the other end of the stage, and maybe I should fault Kasich less because he had to answer first. But still, I mean,
do you think that was an instance of Rand Paul trying to be flippant in a funny way?
I mean,
I'm with you that kind of flops, but I'm wondering if that was his attempt at humor.
Churchill said that a fanatic is someone who won't change his mind and can't change the subject. And Rand Paul just seems, that line made me think of that as this kind of, you know, everything comes back to my agenda. Oh, how was your weekend? What was the weather like when you went camping? Well, I suppose you're for Jeb. Or, well, I was very bothered by the male patriarchy that was oppressing me. Or, it was bothered by the establishment that we need to beat down. They've betrayed me. All I asked was about how your camping trip went. I don't care about your political agenda. But some people, it always comes back to that. You know, and maybe people get this impression of me on Facebook, but you know, I don't actually answer that question. Well, it would have been fine, but for Pope Francis. There are actually things going on in the world that don't relate to your pet issues, but Rand Paul really comes across as being that kind of, and this is, we mentioned before we started, and I don't think it's really come up, the Jonah Goldberg podcast that you led me to, and he talks about ideologue and how ideologue has become a dirty word, and I completely agree with him that it shouldn't be. There's nothing wrong with being an ideologue, but when people use that word, that is what they have in mind, I think. In mind that this kind of fanatical, everything relates to my pet issue kind of thing. Peter might be another good example mentioned earlier, and so I don't know that he was trying to be funny. It would be nice to think so, but I'm not sure that I buy it. Okay, one item that, this is like a terrible week for this, because I've got a bunch of talking to do here and I can't actually talk. So we had talked on episode 4, I think, about why people remain Anglicans, and I have reading a book conveniently titled Why I'm Still Anglican, which is a folio of 15, I think I described it last time as essays, but I think some of them are interviews by various people, and this is still Anglican rather than Episcopalian. It is quite tethered to England. The only person in the entire book that says something that I would think would be a good reason to be an Anglican is a novelist who says, among other things, I regard it as the most theologically faithful church, which is a good reason to be a member of the church. I might quibble whether that's a good description of Anglicanism, but yeah, that's a good reason. But for the rest of them, Ian Hislop, who is the editor of the satirical magazine Private Eye, if you see me posting things from that occasionally, says that it has a woolly appeal for those of us with woollier minds, and that seems to sum up most of what they talk about. So I want to take like a couple of minutes and try to summarize roughly what seems to be the thrust of all 15. They appreciate that it trusts believers to make their own decisions about what to believe, providing a loose framework rather than a conclusion. It proposes standards rather than imposing tests. And the way I conceptualize that is, if you think of the Catechism of the Catholic Church and following the Baltimore Catechism, proposes essentially three elements for mortal sin. You've got A, you've got B, you've got C. Boom, mortal sin. That's a classic test, rather than a looser standard. I don't know what the Anglicans would propose as the standard for sin, but presumably it's something significantly looser. It doesn't make rigid impositions in liturgy and demands almost nothing in terms of doctrine. It does have doctrines, but they're very loosely tailored, and the truth is they can be given away. And even the 39 Articles, there's a piece in here from the former Bishop of Birmingham who says that he had an objection to one of the 39 articles, and they came up with a weaselly worded way that allowed him to affirm that it was true when it was written, rather than affirming that it was true.
Wow.
Yes. This was the point at which I threw the book across the room and said, "Oh, for Pete's sake." That's about halfway through, so I did pretty well. They like moderation in the sense of the Via Media, keeping to the mean. It's breadth, tolerance, inclusivity, and non-judgmentalness. The same guy who wanted to resist one of the 39 articles says, "I abhor religions that are exclusive." "I am the way, the truth, and the life." Get out! You're being exclusive. That's very judgmental. There's the smattering of parochial and nationalist reasons that you mentioned, that it's not a sect or it's not even a denomination, but rather it's the whole nation's church and belongs to everyone, regardless of their belief, interest, or attendance. They like the parish system, that it can be found anywhere, wherever you go, there's an Anglican parish. There are a few sociological comments that are made. Everywhere is that it's English. It reflects the character and temperament of the English people, and it's the historical church of Britain. If you're a conservative-minded person, it's part of the traditional fabric of Britain. It's rooted in and tethered to the past. There's one that maybe we'll talk about in a different episode about the limits of that kind of cultural conditioning, but be that as it may. It's liturgy and its beauty, doctrinal diversity united by liturgical conformity, although that has now frayed, and several of them complain that as the Book of Common Prayer has faded from common practice, it's created problems. Well, of course it's created problems. If the thing that tethers your church together is the liturgy, and you start screwing with the liturgy. Emotional, familial, and familiar attachments. I thought the line that summed that up best was, "It matters to me in the same way that that I love my hometown." It's mine, they're impressed by its political engagement, which is to say it supports political causes that I like. And in some substance, it's timeless, comforting, comfortable, generous, capacious, and undemanding, and quite often simply the default choice.
Wow.
So, when I've called some Catholics crypto-Anglicans in the past, I had no idea how right I was.
I think I have it.
Yeah.
It's the Budweiser of Christianity.
Yeah.
It has drinkability.
Yeah.
Anglicanism.
Yeah.
Drinkability. Yeah. I like that.
But essentially, there was nothing in there that surprised me or that really diverged from what you were saying when we talked about it before. I certainly wouldn't be comfortable asserting any of that. But this is... I'm not making this up. This is in the book. This is not me putting words in their mouths. I mean, maybe... broadly in terms of characterization, but this is what's in there. This is what they were asked, "Why are you still an Anglican?" And this is what they answered. And honestly, I am unimpressed by any of this. Now, I say that, but I want to be very clear. I sympathize with all of those reasons. Everything they say are good reasons why I am still very attached to the Anglican tradition. It is why I would be a member of Northern Area Parish if there were one here in town. None of them are unreasonable points to make, but what they're not, it seems to me, is peculiar to Anglicanism and so decisive between churches. And so if your reason for being an Anglican is you like liturgy, not the specific liturgy of Anglicanism, but liturgy, well, there are a lot of churches that have liturgy. You are probably going to be inclined toward Lutheranism, Catholicism, Orthodoxy, maybe Methodism, depending on the particular congregation. But none of this stuff is decisive. But then, funnily enough, I mentioned the Jordan Goldberg podcast, and I was listening to that just before I came over here, and there's a point that he makes that conservatives and liberals come at politics not by answering the same question in different ways, but they have actually completely different questions that they're framing their approach to. Conservatives tend to approach it from the perspective of ideas. Progressives tend to approach it from the perspective of building tribes and coalitions of interest groups. And it occurred to me that maybe the reason that none of the stuff in this book is in any way persuasive to me is because we're not even answering the same question. To me, the answer to a question like, "Why are you an Anglican, Catholic, what have you," should pertain to the truth claims of the religion.
Mm-hmm.
And they may just be conceptualizing this in an entirely different way. And I don't know what to do with that. That's a very alien way of thinking to me. But that may be why the answers are not just not persuasive, but they're not even addressing the right question to the way that I would think about it. You know, these are all perfectly good thoughts. You know, they're just not decisive as to the question that was tendered. Am I off base there?
I don't think you're off base. For a lot of them, it doesn't have to do with truth. It has to do with what they're familiar with, or their history, or what feels good, or, you know, they have higher values than truth. Hmm. And I don't know the way to get at that.
There's almost an anachronistic feel to it that, well, I became a Christian, and so I went to the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, but where else would I have gone? Which, you know, was an awkward position to take in 1600, but today is just an absurd position to take. After I became a Christian, it was incredibly obvious to me that there are all of these competing sects, each of which make competing and mutually exclusive claims on the truth. And you're going to have to evaluate those. You can't just say, well, I'm a Christian, so I'm going to go to the church, because there is no the church. And, you know, maybe that's the point that they're trying to get at when talking about a national church. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a Christian, so I go to the church.
Yeah.
But in fact, that's there is no the church. You know, you could, you know, just as easily go down the road. Well, there's a parish everywhere. Well, that's nice, but there's a Catholic parish just about everywhere, and there's probably a Methodist. Do they call them parishes? I assume they do. Mm.
No, not usually.
They don't? Okay. Certainly there'd be a Lutheran parish in most major cities. You know? It's quite befuddling for me. As I say, my interest in the subject outstrips my familiarity with it, and having read this, I can still say I feel pretty ignorant about it a bit, because I don't feel that they've told me anything that I can really process.
Well, there's a fundamental disjunct that you're experiencing. Mm-hmm. And I think it is related to asking different questions. I think that for most modern people, the question they ask when they decide what their religion will be, or if they'll continue in their religion, is the religion what I want? Mm-hmm. And that's not the question that the three of us in this room would ask. Mm-hmm. And when I was exploring Buddhism, the question for me wasn't, is this the religion that I want, but is this true? Mm-hmm. And is this more true than what I currently believe? Mm-hmm. And I imagine it was a similar kind of question for you. And that is absolutely not even remotely the question they're asking.
What befuddles me, because I understand the idea of a national church and being attached to national church if you're a nationalist. You know, if you are Thomas Hobbes, then you're all about the Church of England, because the Church of England is the other tool in the hand of your sovereign. The sovereign in England holds the sword and holds the crocher, holds the state and church. But the bishops of England aren't nationalists. The Anglicans, England's no longer nationalist in many respects. There's a bit of a resurgence there. But, you know, it's kind of odd to be attached and talk about the national church if you don't believe in your nation's greatness.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there were a few sociological arguments in various places. The moral framework that's provided by it, and the social milestones that baptism used to. One of them talks about baptism has kind of disappeared, and that was a useful social ritual. So, can we come up with a different social ritual of initiation for the very young? And in the same way, he says, maybe we could think about taking the experience of the bar mitzvah as a rite of slash confirmation, as a rite of passage. And he's talking inferredly about the secular state providing these alternative civic rituals of initiation.
Mm-hmm.
These are not necessarily bad ideas. They're kind of astringent the first time you read it, but it's not necessarily a bad idea psychologically that a culture would have rituals associated with various stages of life, regardless of its religious beliefs. But again, they're not really beliefs that should be decisive between religious faiths. You know, and the very fact that he's talking about borrowing from a bar mitzvah underscores that point. Britain could just as well be Jewish and still do what he's talking about having rituals of initiation at various stages of life. Gosh.
What I find really interesting about it is that it essentially proves a lot of atheists right about a lot of Christians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they charge many Christians with just holding on to these beliefs for, you know, social reasons, reasons of comfort, you know, not because it's true. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that that book, at least in large part, is making a very persuasive case that they're correct about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to push back slightly, but not too far on that point, which is that I don't doubt the sincerity of any of these people as Christians. I'm sure they're perfectly good Christians. It's more the, when you're talking about what's true sets a baseline. If I were unpersuaded by, I don't want to get too deep into my own story because I don't believe much that biography is terribly useful, but once I converted, the next step, it seemed apparent to me, was, as I mentioned, you've got all these competing claims. And it seemed to me that the logical way, the place to start, was with the church that made the most restrictive truth claims. Because if those claims are true, then you're done. If those claims are not true, then you just move down to the next one that has the next least restrictive ones. And so I started with the Catholic Church and was persuaded by its claims. But if that were not true, then you'd move down and you'd tackle the Orthodox claims. And if those weren't true, you'd move down and tackle Anglicanism's claims. If Anglicanism, by its own lights, is quite unrestrictive about doctrine, and maybe this is the place to bring up fundamentalism, which, correctly understood, suggests that Christianity should be defined by allegiance to certain core principles, and everything else is negotiable. At its best, that's all fundamentalism is. There are some non-negotiable points over here, and everything else, you know, if you're a Southern Baptist, you check all those boxes, that's fine. If you are a sincere Northern Baptist, you check all these boxes, you're fine. You're a Methodist, check all these boxes, you're fine. If you're an Episcopalian who's not a atheist heretic, you can check these boxes, you're fine. Yeah. That's not how it works operationally in practice quite often, but I think that's really what they're driving at with Anglicanism. And so I could see that, you know, you say, well, I believe quite sincerely in this set of things that are true, but these things are in no way capable of being decisive towards these claims by other churches. And so all of their competing claims are awash, and so I'm just going to pick the one that is most most conducive to me. And I guess I could see that being true in some universe. I have a hard time getting to how that would work, because to me these claims are mutually exclusive. You know, it does actually matter what the origins and prerogatives of the Bishop of Rome are. To me, at least. I find it hard to imagine, even if I were on the other side of the question, that it would not be an important question.
I don't doubt their sincerity. But, I mean, there's a wide gulf between someone's sincerity and whether or not they're a good Christian. Especially, you know, there's laymen in those, in these books, but there's bishops as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm more likely to hold the bishops and to account for doing things like denying the tenets of their faith.
Yeah.
You know, if you're denying or trying to weasel your way out of the tenets of your faith, I'm sorry, you're not a good Christian.
Right.
Not in the way I define it.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'd imagine you're not very good at whatever your religion is if your goal is to weasel out of the key tenets of that religion. You know, if you're a Jain monastic who goes around doing what I did tonight and killing lots of bugs, then you're a really bad Jain monastic.
Yeah.
And it really is a matter of following your own beliefs. If you say, I'm a Jain monastic, and you don't follow those, well, you're not a very good one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm inclined to say that I'm a bad Catholic because I don't always follow the teachings of the Catholic Church in my everyday life. And that's okay, if you're willing to own that.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not willing to own that, if you're willing to say, well, I'm actually right about this, but my religion is wrong about it, and I'm going to stay here. I have some questions about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have some questions about exactly the extent of your sincerity at that point.
I have more to say about that, but I need to go away and think about that some more. Okay. So we'll maybe follow up on follow-up.
So follow-up.
Yeah. Yeah. The dream goes three layers. Next time on the podcast, the dream goes three layers deep. But, yeah,
we need a kick.
I'll have more to say about that next time. I just need to go away and listen back to this and rethink about it. But yeah, I do agree that, though, that I think that if Dawkins read this book, certainly he would feel vindicated. I'm not sure that he would necessarily be vindicated. But yeah, I will send him a copy and let him have fun with it. Although I was surprised to see this week that there was something that he did that I completely agreed with. He was very critical of people who want to make universities safe spaces,
mm.
and essentially told them on Twitter to just pack up and go home because they're children. Which is kind of like when we were talking about the Sam Harris piece. You know, it is kind of nice to see that these atheist assholes are not just assholes to the people that disagree with them on religion. They are also assholish to anyone who disagrees with them about anything. You know, that this isn't just vitriol reserved for us. They're very certain of themselves on everything, really. You know, and I happen to agree with them about safe spaces, but, you know, I would probably say that, well, we could be wrong. I mean, you know, maybe there's a plausible argument for having safe spaces. Certainly there's an argument for having physically safe spaces. You know, maybe there's an argument for at least having, you know, trigger warnings on classes in the syllabus.
You mean class descriptions?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have a problem with that.
Just class descriptions.
Right. But, you know, what I'm saying is that, you know, I agree with him, but I'm much less certain that we're right than he is. Or at least that there are no conceivable things that could be said in favor of these things.
You had an interesting article about that.
About the trigger warnings?
Yeah, yeah.
And how they failed?
Yes.
I don't think I saw that one.
It was something I posted online in the Freethinkers group.
Okay.
About a professor who was ousted because, despite the fact that she really believed in trigger warnings and implemented them as much as possible in her classroom. You know, she really tried to be accommodating to that whole mode of doing things in academia. It just wasn't enough for the students.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they wanted to be able to take this class that was explicitly about sexuality, and human sexuality, and not be exposed to some of the things about human sexuality they didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And fair enough. I would say, okay, if you are in a state that you can't emotionally deal with frank discussions or imagery of a sexual nature that's not really, you know, something you can process. If you, for whatever reason, you can't process that data, if your brain shuts down, then what you should probably do is say, okay, there's a reason that my brain is shutting down when this happens. I need to talk to a counselor or a psychologist, a psychiatrist about why that is. The appropriate answer is not, I'm going to take this class and then blame the professor for showing the material that was in the course description. And especially when I've been given extensive trigger warnings that say, hey, this stuff is coming up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that to me is an easy case because what you're talking about there is essentially someone who wants to have the piece of paper that says you know, this person has qualified in X, but they don't want to actually learn X because they have a problem with the content. You know, that is a class that is almost inherently going to contain, you know, if you have a visceral fear of sex, then you shouldn't take a class on sexual expression. You know, by contrast, if someone is taking a civil engineering class, and there's going to be, you know, brief references to Playboy in it, then it's reasonable for them to expect a trigger warning for that piece of it, because it's something that's orthogonal to the content of the class.
Mm-hmm.
We had a meeting a couple of years ago, an all-staff meeting, and this person came in and was essentially trying to gin up support for people coming to this kind of staff wellness class. And that's not a bad cause, and it's not an inappropriate bullet point for the meeting. But she went on and showed this extremely graphic video about liposuction being performed, and, you know, like an open-heart surgery kind of thing. That, you know, honestly, I don't think I was the only one in the room who was very uncomfortable about this. This was not, you know, I'm not necessarily squeamish about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I know some people are more squeamish about that than I am, and there are other things that I am squeamish about that I wouldn't, that could come up in the same kinds of context. That's the kind of thing for which that should have had a trigger warning, because no one walking into that meeting, even if they had read the agenda, would expect that kind of thing to come up. It's the kind of thing that, even just as a matter of basic courtesy, you know. But if you have a class on, effects of rape culture, you know, advanced feminist themes in feminism 301, rape culture, and you are concerned that discussion of rape is going to trigger you, you have no business being in that class. You should not take that class. And so it seems to me that the example that you're talking about is someone wanting to have it both ways. It's not even really just about triggering, it's that they want it both ways.
They want their cake,
mm-hmm.
they want to eat their cake, and you really better make sure that's a good cake. That's totally on you. It has mm-hmm. nothing to do with that.
Yep. Yeah, I read the article, and, you know, I wouldn't be comfortable in that class.
Right.
You know, I probably wouldn't have taken that course. That course, mm-hmm. they sit and watch explicit depictions of sex.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be rather uncomfortable sitting in a class full of people watching explicit depictions of sex. But that's why I didn't take the course.
Since we're on campus, I wanted to do a follow-up on what we were talking about last time. I want to follow up on the synod, but we just don't have the time. We've been talking an hour and a half, and I've got to go to mass shortly, so I just want to put that off for another day. But we talked last time about the affirmative consent stuff. This thought occurred to me. One of the things we talked about was we're not really any of us that dismayed that this has the effect of discouraging fornication. What do you think would have happened if we had proposed affirmative consent as a blue law? If, like, the Catholic bishops had come out before the left started proposing affirmative consent as this kind of tool, if we had come out and said, we need to drive down fornication by attaching legal consequences to it, therefore we are going to require people to sign a contract before they have sex, because we think this will discourage people from doing them. Do you think that the left would have approved of that law? And if not, what kind of response would we have gotten?
Well, you know, we would have been called, you know, chauvinists, you know, and forging the contract clearly represents it's a hearkening, clearly would be a hearkening back to slavery, and we are selling women's bodies by signing this contract. It's clearly just a purchasing of women's bodies. But, you know, whenever the left proposes it, whenever the state of California proposes it, it's not that. I think that's one of the routes they would go, if we proposed that. Yeah.
My guess is that there would be a very tiny minority of people who consider themselves liberal or progressive who would say, you know, there are actually liberal or progressive reasons we might want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
In that case. I'm guessing it would be a tiny minority, because generally people don't take well to propositions from the other side, and I'm using proposition here intentionally. They don't take well to it when it's proposed by the other side. You know, you can very much see that sort of thing with Obamacare. Setting aside the question of federalism,
mm-hmm.
I think that Republicans would have been much more amenable to the framework of Obamacare had it been proposed under a Republican White House.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
So that particular problem is just a general human problem.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I think that can perhaps be oversold. I mean, the line that the other side used, well, look, this was an idea that the Heritage Foundation originated, and, you know, Romney Care in Massachusetts. You know, I don't know that that stuff is decisive, but I think you're right that there is an intuitive skepticism when the other side proposes anything. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that that's inappropriate. It's not attractive, but I don't know that it's wrong. I mean, when you frame it that way, when you're that bald about it, then yeah, it looks pretty bad to think of it in those terms. But the reality is that whenever we get any new information, and we talked about prejudice, and hey, we're tying more follow up into it, it all circulates pretty well. You know, that's one of the values of prejudice, that when you get new information. Coincidentally, also one of the values of education. One of the reasons we educate people is so that they're not totally flummoxed by new information. They have a framework, that is to say a prejudice, by which they can evaluate new information. And so when you get a new policy proposal, particularly when it's quite complicated, one of the first things you're going to look at is the people who have studied this in an awful lot of detail are people who I fundamentally disagree with. And so even before I think about it in the same level of detail, then I'm thinking that if they disagree with me on everything, then they're probably not going to propose something that I'm likely to agree with, and so I'm going to come at this with some skepticism. Mm-hmm. The art to it, then, is holding yourself open to reevaluating it, because I think what you just said, Sam, is exactly the right response. You know, it's like, I hate you, how dare you completely agree with me and propose something sensible and logical.
Yeah.
I support this proposal, but I still hate you.
So, with the affirmative consent, do you think we could convince California to attach a 3-day waiting period?
Oh, that's cold, Mike. That's cold.
I don't know if we could convince them, but I think that the website Jezebel could.
Yeah, yeah. Or maybe requiring some mandatory video training. Like the miracle of childbirth videos before you sign the contract. See if that'll change some lines.
Yeah.
They'll certainly sober up.
Yeah, I think in the case of the affirmative consent proposal being proposed by Catholic bishops, the difference between what you're talking about, which is skepticism, or what I was pointing to, was that I was pointing to exactly the opposite of skepticism. I was pointing to something that's very, very certain. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say, I'm not sure about this, let me look at this more because I'm not sure about it. It says, I'm very sure that these people on the other side could not possibly be proposing something good, and so I'm going to oppose it.
Mm. Let's close it up, although I'm going to be late for mass. Yep. Do we have any final thoughts? I think we've hit every previous podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
I think. And we even touched on, I think we had a couple of new points. Yeah. So we got some new business done. We got through the old business.
A little bit of new, a little bit of old.
We had some beer, we had some sci-fi. You know,
anything borrowed?
Yeah, you know, some of the points I've made have been borrowed from this book.
So,
and, you know, a lot of this makes us sad, so we're blue.
There we go.
I also had a blueberry beer, so
there you go. That's the theme of tonight, Ross. Something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue.